Please. Yeah, you can block for that.
Hey! Hey, Mom.
We're pleased you're here tonight. We have something special planned for you before we get too far. Got one of those? Please, silence your favorite government evil ringtone, if you don't mind. Also, we don't necessarily encourage photography or video. Why? Those of you who've been here before, you know we have cameras running here. We have an archive here at the Grammy Museum where you can come anytime on the third floor, find out what great artists had to say and do on any of the programs that we have presented since December of 2008. And speaking of great programs, let me tell you about some things we have coming up here. On October 29th, which would be Thursday, we do a series here called Reel to Reel, where we screen films of music-related content, documentaries, and on that night, we have a film called Keith Richards, Under the Influence. Terrific documentary about the Rolling Stones guitarist, and the director, whom you may know, directed the film 20 Feet from Stardom. Morgan Neville will be here to talk about the film after the screening. On November 2nd, another reel-to-reel evening, Janis, Little Girl Blue, about Janis Joplin. On November 3rd, the Grammy Museum gives out an award to an educator who uses music in innovative ways in their classroom. It's called the Jane Ortner Education Award, and on that night we'll be doing a benefit for that to award, make that award, and Jackson Brown will be here that night.
Yeah,
pretty cool. On November 4th, we're doing a panel here, an interesting discussion about Bob Dylan and whether or not he may be the greatest songwriter to ever have been produced in this country. And the panel will feature a guy named John Breen, who just wrote a book about Dylan, as well as, get these names, Dan Wilson, great songwriter, semi-sonic, wrote a bunch of hits for Dixie Chicks and others, Lucinda Williams,
yeah,
will be on that panel, as well as the executive director of the Grammy Museum, not me, Bob Santelli. On November 9th, great new band, wonderful. They just put out a full-length album called Hound Mouth. We'll be here. If you don't know them, check them out. On November 17th, an evening with Marty Ballin.
Yeah.
From Jefferson Airplane. And on November 19th, a conversation with Peter Guralnick and Conan O'Brien. So lots of cool stuff coming up. Also know that our guest tonight will be out in the retail store signing copies of his new CD after the program. While we're at it, a round of applause for our sponsor, American Express. We very much appreciate your support here at the Grammy Museum, but let's chat a little bit about why we're here tonight. It's been about 5 years since our guest tonight released a solo album, but his work as a solo artist is just one part of a remarkable and remarkably varied career. He's belonged to three, and you know this, of the greatest live groups in rock history, the Allman Brothers Band, The Dead, and his own Government Mule. And as if that is not enough, he's toured and recorded with Phil Lesh, Little Milton, Derek Trucks, and the Dave Matthews Band, among many, many others. He's here tonight following the release of his terrific new album entitled Ashes and Dust. Would you please welcome Warren?
So,
thank you so much for coming back. You were here, as I said, about 5 years. It's unbelievable.
It doesn't seem like 5 years.
Yeah. Since you did Man in Motion, but I want to start by talking about the new record because you know, for those who are just kind of, you know, looking at your career in a survey sense, this is a bit kind of outside what people might associate with a record of yours. Tell us a little bit about how this record came together.
Well, I've been writing these kind of songs my entire life. They're coming from a singer-songwriter direction. very influenced by folk music, Celtic music, Appalachian music. And I wanted to make this kind of record about 7 years ago, before I made Man in Motion. I was supposed to make a record with Levon Helm and Leon Russell and a bass player named T-Bone Wolk. And T-Bone passed away, and then Levon passed away, and so that record never happened. Mm-hmm. And so I turned around and made Man in Motion because I had written a lot of soul meets blues kind of songs as well. But some of these songs would have been on that record, albeit a little differently. And then I've just been continuing to write since then, and I felt like I'd accumulated enough songs that needed the same sort of treatment that it was time for me to make another solo record.
And I mean, some of these songs go back 20 years.
Some of them, maybe half of them.
Yeah.
Well, anywhere from 5, 10, 20 years. Some are brand new. And we actually recorded 25 songs. Uh-huh. And I chose the 13 that I felt like were the most cohesive statement. Not even so much my favorite ones, just the ones that sounded like a complete record.
Yeah.
And so some of the ones that we haven't released yet are new and some are old, but there's definitely a follow-up in the works.
Oh, yes. And getting back to the idea of a complete statement, I think you are the kind of artist who still considers an album, you know, kind of as a whole, a work of art as a whole.
Absolutely.
Yeah, talk about that and why that's important to you.
Well, because Sgt. Pepper's had up until 1967, records were a collection of songs, but from 1967 till 1973, which I consider to be the golden era of rock music, people made records, whether they were conceptual or not. They had a personality that started with the first song and ended with the last song. Mm-hmm. There was also that gap in the middle where you had to get up and turn the record over. So it was side one and side two.
Right.
I still think of things as side one and side two. But more importantly, I just think that the songs have to tell a story, and nothing should be completely out of place, but nothing should be redundant. So that's the way I choose the songs.
Yeah. And you said that these, you know, these songs sort of tell, you know, a story of where you were at the varying points at which these were written in your personal life. And wondering, as you go back to, you know, potentially songs that are 20 years old, what did you learn about yourself?
That's a good question. I think writing is one way of learning about yourself in general. I think one of the things I learned is I wasn't as good a songwriter back then. Some of the songs, the ones that I kept, I love.
Yeah.
But some of the ones that I didn't keep, there was a good reason.
Yeah. I mean, were there some songs that you know, there was maybe, you know, a nugget, a verse, a bridge, a chorus, or something that really worked that you then had to kind of rework to?
Occasionally that happens. Usually I tend to keep tweaking them and tweaking them, and if it's a song I love, then by the time I consider it ready to look at as a complete song, I've thought it through so many times. So, with the case of the song like Is It Me or You, which is the first song on Ashes and Dust, that's the oldest song. And so everybody says, oh, did you have to rewrite it or rework it? No, it's exactly the way I wrote it, but that's why it still stands up, as opposed to songs from that time period that I didn't decide to record.
You, in talking about this record, you said something that I love. You said that folk music is meant to be reckoned with, and I love that. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's challenging, right? I mean, lyrically, melodically, emotionally, it's not just audio wallpaper, which is a term Alan Woody used to use all the time. A lot of the music that we've come to embrace, I guess, in some ways, is just kind of unchallenging, unthreatening audio wallpaper. And folk music was more than that. Folk music was the Jimi Hendrix of its day. And in each era of folk music was that, in the way that it wasn't for the faint at heart. It could be. I mean, there were folk sing-along songs and songs that, you know, were happy. But a lot of, when you look at what influenced Bob Dylan, who, by the way, is the greatest songwriter of all time.
Duly noted.
I'm not on the panel, but...
I'll make sure they know.
I don't know. I'm sure Lucinda will agree with me. But folk music was, it was a way of communicating. It was a way of keeping history alive, of keeping pertinent information through music alive that wasn't just record keeping, you know. And there's so much stuff that you can look at as being folk music, different regions. It was so heavy that people forget, you know. Like there's a song on Ashes and Dust called Cold Tattoo that was written by my friend Billy Ann Wheeler. Well, the original version of that was recorded in the 60s by the Kingston Trio. But the Kingston Trio, after Bob Dylan went electric, the Kingston Trio was kind of looked at as passe and maybe a little too homey. I don't know if that's even the right way to look at it. But at the time, they were heavy. That was heavy music, you know. And when you listen to what they were doing now, it was meant to be reckoned with, and I stand by that.
But speaking of Dylan, I mean, you've said that Dylan opened up the world to you in many ways. Well, talk to us about Dylan and his impact on you.
Well, when I first started hearing Dylan, luckily because I had two older brothers, I was exposed to that music at a very young age. And even before I was old enough to grasp lyrically where it was coming from, you could feel the weight of it. And of course, my oldest brother used to try and explain to me how heavy these songs were, you know. But there was something about the way it made you feel. And then with each decade, he would reinvent himself. He was like Miles Davis in the way that he never looked backwards. Mm-hmm. He would write songs for 10 years, and then he would kind of not turn his back, but just say, okay, I've done that, now this is what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. And in each case, similar to Miles Davis, he was 2 years ahead of his audience. The audience would be questioning with each record, I don't know if I'm into this, you know.
Yeah.
And then 2 years later, oh, this is the greatest thing I ever heard, you know. But then he was on to something else. I can't imagine, in the same way that I can't imagine there ever being another creative force like the Beatles, I can't imagine anyone ever writing that many amazing songs.
I mean, one of the things that is, you know, certainly surprising to me in thinking about Ashes and Dust is, and you've said this, that you've been writing these kinds of songs all along, and yet you're known for, you know, Government Mule and the Dead and Allman Brothers Band and this kind of stuff. I'm wondering what besides Dylan, what other songwriters were influencing you? Who else were you hearing?
Well. Let's go back to the very beginning. The first song that I remember making an impact was Sounds of Silence by Simon Garfunkel.
Sure.
And I think I was 5 years old. And I was definitely not tuning in to the message and the lyric. But again, the heaviness of the song just kind of freaked me out. And as I got older and realized how much deeper it was than what I even knew, so I like a lot of the Simon and Garfunkel stuff, but I listen to a lot of, James Taylor and Jackson Browne and stuff, more contemporary type stuff, but still amazing songwriters, you know, because I wanted to learn how to be a great songwriter, And so if it meant listening to Gordon Lightfoot or if it meant listening to Pink Floyd, I was going to study every great songwriter that there was, you know. When John Prine's first record came out, my brother played it for me, and I flipped out. I'd never heard anything like that.
Yeah. But you grew up in a part of the country where, you know, folk and bluegrass music are, you know, kind of bedrock. And I'm wondering how much of that, you know, you heard, particularly bluegrass and traditional, you know, acoustic roots music you heard growing up.
Well, my dad was into Bill Monroe and Ralph Stanley and Hank Williams. And eventually George Jones and Merle Haggard, but he focused on those few things.
Yeah.
And my dad had a beautiful singing voice. He still does. He's 81. He's still alive. So I heard that music, and I was able to see people like Doc Watson and Norman Blake at a young age.
Yeah.
And was floored by it. But I was also, you know, studying blues and jazz and rock and roll, and so it was just one of the things that was fascinating to me. But I was lucky because I had befriended these folk singer-songwriters, and they were kind of taking me under their wing.
Mm-hmm.
They would show me Dylan songs that I had never heard. They would turn me on to folk music that I had never heard. And equally important, they would play songs that they had written that were just as good.
Yeah. Yeah, you did this record with a band from New Jersey,
Railroad Earth.
How did you find these guys?
Well, I had known about them, and then they opened a show for the Allman Brothers at Red Rocks, and I really enjoyed hearing their set, and we wound up doing some playing together. But then I got booked on a couple of festivals as a solo acoustic act. And it's a little intimidating, you know. I love doing solo acoustic, but one of the shows was like 90 minutes or something, and the guys from Railroad Earth were there, and I thought, well, maybe I should invite them out to join me. So we rehearsed in my dressing room for, you know, half hour. And, that's a luxury, believe me. And we played a few songs together, and it went quite well. And then fast forward to when they reopened the Capitol Theater in Port Chester, New Jersey, they asked me to do two nights, one night with the Warren Haynes Band, which is the soul music meets blues band that I do. And they wanted me to do the other night solo acoustic, and I thought, well, maybe I'll invite the Railroad Earth guys out for that. We had a little more time to prepare and to rehearse, and it went great. It was just kind of magical, you know. So it was after that night I started thinking, I think that's the way I would like to make my next record.
I want to talk a little bit about, you know, kind of the recording process for this record, because I found some of it pretty interesting. You said you wanted to capture the songs with everybody hearing them for the first time. So how does that work in reality?
I love the way music sounds when people are playing a song for the first time. Government Mule tries to work that way to whatever extent we can. In the context of like these songs, which are more coming from a folk direction, they're not really complicated songs. So I would go into the studio each morning, show the guys a song that they had never heard. We would talk about the arrangement that I had kind of come up with and talk about how to expand it, and everybody bringing in suggestions. And then we would record it, and hopefully in the first two or three takes we would have something we liked, and we would move on to another song that they had never heard before. I asked them about that in advance, if they would be cool with doing it that way, and they said yeah, they enjoyed that approach. So to me, you can hear it in the music, the freshness of musicians playing something for the first time. I really think there's something about that.
Yeah. I was telling you before, I had the great privilege to spend some time with Greg Allman a few weeks ago here. And we talked a lot about, you know, the brothers and history, but we talked about songwriting and recording. And he said, you know, in this day and age, you know, a lot of it is about, you know, making things perfect and quantizing and all that. And he said, songs have to breathe.
Yeah.
They speed up, they slow down. He said, that's what people react to. In the studio, are you going for that, you know, that kind of vibe as opposed to worrying about perfection?
No, I think we all learned a long time ago that perfection in music should not be uttered in the same sentence.
Here.
I think we all draw the line somewhere of what is a little too imperfect.
Yeah.
But even some stuff that bothers me wouldn't bother you,
mm-hmm.
and vice versa.
Sure.
I noticed that a lot of the records I grew up listening to had mistakes on them, but they didn't seem like mistakes to me.
Mm-hmm.
As I got older and as I got to be more accomplished as a musician, I would go, oh, that was a mistake, but it's beautiful. It's part of the music, and it's very human, and it's very compelling. The Allman Brothers have a history with Tom Dowd, the producer,
yes.
and I did 5 records with Tom, and I learned a lot from him about that because, you know, he worked with Coltrane, he worked with Ray Charles, and he worked with the Allman Brothers, and he was very good at discerning when the performance was right, even if there were mistakes in it, and even if it was a mistake you could fix, sometimes he would convince you not to. And I remember him talking to me about listening as if I bought the record and didn't know what to expect. And he would say, if it still bothers you, then we'll go back and fix it. And when you listen that way, it doesn't bother you. It sounds like beautiful music.
Did that take you a minute to kind of execute that, you know, to kind of get out of your musician head and get into more of an audience?
Yeah, I mean, it was a process. I've been somewhat open to that philosophy my entire life.
Yeah.
But when someone as heavy as Tom Dowd is talking about your own mistakes and how it doesn't sound like a mistake to me, then I, at that point, I'm compelled to be more open-minded and to kind of take his words.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Dowd was such a, you know, a monumental figure. You know, not only in the history of the brothers, but as you said, all these other great artists he worked with. What did you learn from working with him?
Not to dwell on things. You know, he, it was an overall picture to him, you know. And as musicians, as songwriters, as artists, we tend to kind of tear things apart and analyze them, and I learned how to think of the overall picture, I guess in the same way as like a listener, you know. And it's funny because to this day, one of the things that I tell young musicians is don't listen to music like a musician, listen to music like a fan. Because we were fans before we were musicians. That's why we became musicians. So don't let the fact that you studied something take away the love that you had of the raw ingredients.
Yeah,
of it.
Right. There's an interesting choice of covers on the record, one of which, Gold Dust Woman, Fleetwood Mac song. So what was it about that song that
Well, I always loved that song.
Yeah.
The first time I heard it, I loved it. I wasn't necessarily a huge fan of that era of Fleetwood Mac. I was more into the earlier mm-hmm. stuff, the Peter Green stuff and all that kind of stuff.
People here agreeing with that choice.
And, you know, but that era made some amazing music.
Yeah.
It was just all over the radio, so even if you didn't want to hear it, you heard it. And so the first time I heard Gold Dust Woman, I thought, man, that's a beautiful, beautiful song. I never thought about doing it. And then when Grace Potter and I became friends and we started working together, we would think of songs to cover when we would collaborate. And Gold Dust Woman came up, and it was nice. Our voices blended well together. we had never thought of recording it until I was making this record with all the Celtic influence and the mm-hmm. acoustic instruments. And I called Grace one day and said, what do you think about doing Goldust Woman, but doing it more acoustic with upright bass and, you know, fiddle and yeah. mandolin? And she said, yeah, let's do it. So she came by the studio, we did it, it turned out great, and I'm really yeah. proud of it.
One of the things that you said about, particularly about that track, is that you waited to record that until very late at night, around midnight.
Yeah.
Why? What is it about that time of day?
Well, there was three songs, that one and Hallelujah Boulevard, and a song that we didn't include that we're going to use on one of the follow-ups.
Part two.
That I wanted to capture the feeling that musicians have late at night when their brain is tired and all the filters go away. You play music in a different way. It's more relaxed. It's less analytical. It's more poetic and stream of consciousness, mm-hmm. you know. And I think about the Van Morrison record, Astral Weeks. Nobody on that music, nobody's playing a repeating part or a pattern. They're all just having a conversation musically. And that's what I wanted to capture. So I asked the guys, do you mind staying late? Because we usually were done by 10 or 11. So I said, on a couple of nights, let's go midnight or 1 o'clock and see if we can capture this feeling. And we only do three takes. You know,
yeah.
I like to
yeah.
do things in threes. So we would do three takes, and then we go home and not even listen back to what we just did and come back the next day and go, yeah, that was good. and so that's what I was trying to capture is, I don't know, there's a subtle kind of magic that happens. It's kind of similar to what happens when you don't know the tape's rolling.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You know,
yeah. Yeah, there's a relaxed kind of vibe to it.
Absolutely.
Right. There are a couple other covers that I want to ask you about, and songs that you've done, you know, with other bands. Spots of Time, which you did with the Brothers, and Glory Road, which you did with the Dead. Why choose those for this record?
Well, because the Allman Brothers didn't make a final record. I think Spots of Time and another song that we had been doing, Dusk Till Dawn, which I'm doing live in our shows now, we were looking forward to recording both of those songs, and we had a handful of other tunes, but we never made that record. And so they were fresh on my mind, and I thought it'd be nice to record them this way. So I brought in Oteil Burbridge and Mark Quinones from the Allman Brothers to help out. You know, things just have a way of working out. Oddly, sometimes, after Phil and I wrote Spots of Time, I had never thought of it as an Allman Brothers song. And then one day we were at rehearsal before the Beacon, and Butch Truck says, hey, we got to start playing some new songs. You got any new songs? And I was like, yeah, I got a couple. And I was trying to think, I don't know if they're Allman Brothers songs. So we went through Spots of Time, and it very quickly came together and sounded like an Allman Brothers song. Because I write a lot of songs that I'm not thinking of the Allman Brothers, or I'm not thinking of Government Mule, or I'm not even thinking of myself. I'm just thinking of the song as it comes, and I have to decide later if it makes sense for something else. And in some cases, it'll be someone else that points it out. You know, when I wrote Soulshine, I never thought of it as an Allman Brothers song, but Greg Allman said, we should record Soulshine. And I thought, really? He said, absolutely. And when I heard him sing it, I was like, he's right.
Is that a challenge for you sometimes? Because you are involved, you know, as I said in the open, you've had this remarkably varied career. And is it a challenge sometimes to kind of figure out what bucket to put, you know, music in?
I like that analogy. It's fun. It's a fun challenge.
Oh, I'm sure it's fun.
But it is definitely a challenge because sometimes I'm wrong about, you know, thinking, oh, this song wouldn't be good for this band, but it turns out to be good. But it's about interpretation, you know, because you and I were talking earlier about, right, with Greg and some of the songs that he writes, some of the songs that we've written together.
Yeah.
It's up to the band to interpret the songs a certain way. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the band's interpretation is so strong that it becomes their song. And I think that's a beautiful thing, you know. So I may not envision a song being one that would belong to the Allman Brothers or to Governor Mule, but once they get their hands on it, it may instantly change my mind.
Yeah, and just to illustrate that point, so I was telling you about this program we did with Allman and Eric Church.
Yeah.
So they were going to play Midnight Rider together. So Eric Church knows Midnight Rider from the Allman Brothers, from hearing the Allman Brothers version. As they're walking up, I hear the following. Greg says to Eric, "We're not doing it that way. We're doing it the way I wrote it."
Yeah.
And you could just see Eric's eyes kind of go, huh? And it was, I mean, they pulled it off. It was great. But
Greg was doing the laid-back version,
yes.
Which I actually prefer, yes. too. I think that's my favorite version as well. And there's a lot of that going on right now. Greg's doing a lot of the stuff in his band more like he originally wrote it. I'm doing a lot of stuff right now that reminds me of the way I wrote the songs.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that another interpretation isn't great. It's just nice to kind of get back to that.
Yeah, I'm sure. We've talked, you know, a lot about, you know, kind of what you heard growing up, but you had some very diverse interests and sort of musical influences growing up. Talk a little bit about, because you were interested in singing. I shouldn't say that in such an astounding way. You were interested in singing, more so than guitar playing early on. Who are some of your, you know, sort of singing heroes?
Well, my first hero was James Brown, and my favorite singer is probably Otis Redding. Ray Charles. My early influences were all soul music, and I'm sure, talked about this last time.
Yep.
Levi Stubbs from the Four Tops, Dennis Edwards from the Temptations. That's the way I learned how to sing, was sitting in my bedroom singing along with soul music, you know. At the same time, I was obviously hearing the Beatles and the Stones and hearing this other, you know, singer-songwriter stuff. And it was all due to my two older brothers. They just had great taste and very diverse taste. But soul music was the thing that hit me the hardest the earliest on. And then all my favorite rock singers were white singers that were trying to emulate their favorite black soul singers or blues singers. So it would be, you know, people like Greg Allman and Lowell George and Steve Winwood and Van Morrison and Paul Rogers, people that in their own minds were singing soul music.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And then, you know, in you know, perhaps the ultimate irony, one of your first gigs in music, you get hired by David Allan Coe. Hello. Not exactly a soul musician, but tell me a little bit about working with him and what you learned from that experience.
Well, when I first heard from him that he was looking for a guitar player, I didn't know much about him. I didn't know his music. I definitely didn't know his lifestyle. But it was an opportunity for me to take a step up. And I remember telling him on the phone as a cocky 19-year-old that, you know, I don't consider myself a country guitar player. I'm not really interested in playing country music and that, you know, if I can play like myself, I would be into it. But if I have to play like somebody else, I don't think I would. And he said he was looking for a blues rock guitar player to add an edge to his music. I said, okay, that could be me, I guess. And so I flew to Baton Rouge and joined his band, not knowing, as I said, anything about him or anything. The thing that I took away from all that, I think I, you know, David is a great songwriter in his own right, and studied songwriting very deeply, maybe more so than people realize. And so that kind of pushed me into studying the songwriter thing even more. So that next period of my life was very important for me as a songwriter. And I was really discovering a lot of stuff that I didn't know yet. A lot of writers that I wasn't familiar with yet, that some that he turned me on to and some that I just kind of fell into. The biggest thing that I took away from that was that I met Greg Allman and Dickie Betts through him, which led to me joining Dickie Betts' band, which led to me joining the Allman Brothers. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that. So you joined the Allman Brothers in 89. Tell me about the first time you went to rehearsal with that band. Clearly you knew who they were, you knew the legacy, you knew... I mean, how hard is it to walk into that room?
Well, I was an Allman Brothers fan from the first record. My oldest brother had the first record in 1969. We have a cousin that played bass that had seen the Allman Brothers in Louisiana and thought it was the greatest thing and sent my oldest brother the first Allman Brothers record. So I heard that music from the very beginning. I had not started playing guitar then, but I was fascinated with guitar, and I loved Greg's voice, and I loved the two drummers and the two guitars, and you know, when I was 9 years old. But again, due to my older brothers, I was surrounded by great music, so it was making quite an impression on me. By the time Live at the Fillmore came out, I started playing guitar, and all my friends that played guitar, we all had that record, and we all studied it, and we all loved that music. Fast forward a couple of years, everybody in our circle of musician friends, we all played Allman Brothers songs, and garage bands, and cover bands, and bar bands, and stuff, you know. So I was a huge fan from the very beginning. So it was a big honor for me to meet those guys. Then Dickie and I became friends and stayed in touch. And then when he called me to join his band when I was 26, that was a huge honor for me. At that time, no one suspected that it would lead to a reunion.
Right.
So I was just as shocked as everybody else in 89 when they called and said, we're putting the Allman Brothers back together. We want you to join.
Yeah. You spent 25 years with the Allman Brothers. Is it possible to kind of sum up what that experience meant to you?
It would be like, I can only say that if I were going to join a band that I grew up listening to, the Allman Brothers would be at the absolute top of the list of bands that I would want to join. It's funny because I was a big Little Feat fan as well. And early on, after I joined the Allman Brothers, Little Feat was our opening act. And I would go out every night and play with them. And then play the rest of the night with the Allman Brothers, and some of the guys in Little Feet would join us. And I was thinking, like, this is like two of my all-time favorite bands, and I'm kind of playing with both of them and having a blast. It's very surreal, very overwhelming. It's obviously the greatest opportunity of my career.
Obviously you were, part of the 45th anniversary shows, the final shows. And I'm wondering, What was most memorable to you about those final shows?
Well, when we were rehearsing, it came up in conversation one day that for the final show, we should do three sets. We should play the longest show we've ever played and go past midnight at the Beacon Theater, which never been done, or past 1 o'clock or whatever it was. And everybody instantly said, yeah, let's do that. And so we were all happy that everybody was on the same page for that. The six nights that we did, they were all really good, but they were kind of like dress rehearsals for the last night. The last night was a very special show that I was so proud of us that we were able to make that our last concert. And I think everybody was on the exact same page, you know. And it was just beautiful. We came off stage knowing that we had done a memorable show comparable to our best shows.
Yeah. You know?
And that's what I remember the most, you know.
Has it sunk into you that's done, that the Allman Brothers are done?
Yeah, I guess it's sunk in. You know, I mean, it's, we're all going to miss it. You know, for myself to be part of one of my, not only my favorite bands, but one of the greatest bands in rock history, you know, as a fan, I can say that. You know, I think we all knew it was the right decision to make. You know, we talked about it for about 3 years that the 45th anniversary should be the time to stop, because when I joined the band in 89, all of the original members would occasionally allude to the fact in conversation that the Allman Brothers Band is a unique band in the way that the whole concept is to leave everything on the stage every night. Mm-hmm. You don't go out and go through the motions. You don't go out and play the hits. And they acknowledged that if the time ever came that it was turning into a nostalgia act, it would be time to stop. Thankfully, that time never came, but I think we all saw it on the horizon and knew that it's the right thing. The 45th, we're not going to make it to the 50th, so 45th is the right one.
Yeah. You know, I asked Greg about what he would want people to remember about the Allman Brothers Band, and he said, interestingly, his response was that the audience always got their money's worth. Which I think goes back to what you said about leaving all on the stage. What would you want people to remember about the Allman Brothers?
Well, I would have to agree with his answer. You try to make your bad nights good, your good nights great, and your great nights amazing. And that's what the Allman Brothers did.
So, fair warning, we're going to ask for a couple questions from the house here in a minute, but you had the chance to play with two of, you know, what are now well known as perhaps the best improvisational, and don't take this the wrong way, sort of jam-oriented, for lack of a better term, bands, the Allman Brothers Band and the Dead. But you said something really interesting that I was fascinated by, that there is an East Coast and West Coast approach to this, and a very different vibe, you know, in those two bands. Would you talk a little bit about that, the differences between those bands?
Well, I don't think East Coast, West Coast sums it up entirely, but I do think there's something to that.
Yeah.
In each case, with the Dead or with the Allman Brothers, the difference between a New York audience and a San Francisco audience, night and day.
Yeah.
And so the approach, you combine that with the music that they grew up listening to, because it's different now. Everybody is exposed to everything. But if you go back to the 50s, when these guys were learning how to play, the music that influenced them, a lot of it was regional music. So the regional music that people heard in California was different than the regional music that people heard in Georgia and Florida. That's a big part of it. And just, you know, there's a more laid-back attitude in the Bay Area than there is on the East Coast. But I think in some ways those bands kind of helped redefine that, because they were taking a lot of the same ingredients and absolutely taking the same concept, which was mixing all the things that they loved together in a big improvisational melting pot.
Yeah.
But with completely different approaches. Dickie Betts and I talked about one time his description, and I don't think he would mind me quoting him on this. He said the difference between the Dead's version of improv and the Allman Brothers' version of improv was that the Dead would just relax and wait for it to happen, and the Allman Brothers would make it happen right now. And I think that's a very accurate thing, and they're both beautiful, and I learned a lot from both of those approaches, and I try to utilize both of them.
Yeah.
We'll ask for a couple questions here from the house. Do we have?
That's a good looking group. Yes,
sir. Right here in the baseball cap.
In the last show at the Beacon, was Dickie Betts ever, or was there a thought of him coming out to play the last show?
There was a lot of us that were hoping that would happen and trying to make it happen, but the attempt to make it happen didn't start soon enough. You know, I know it's speaking for myself and Derek and for other people as well. We were never completely comfortable with the thought of there being an Allman Brothers without Dwayne Allman or Dickie Betts because we're such big fans of what they did. But once we had made that decision to do that, you give it 110%, you know, and we respected the legacy so much that I think we were able to put ourselves into it. But I know, speaking for myself, when I think about the Allman Brothers, I think about the original six-piece band with Dwayne and Barry Oakley. That's that's what I grew up with, you know. I really thought Dickie should be there. I understand the reasons why it didn't happen, but I still would like to see them bury the hatchet and play together.
Yeah. Yeah. Who else?
Yes, sir.
I'd like to make a comment. I'm going to really miss seeing you and Derek play together. That was such a treat.
Thank you. You know, the hardest thing, I'll answer the second half first. The hardest thing as a singer is to come into your own where when you open your mouth, you sound like yourself. The greatest accomplishment for any singer and any musician is when someone can hear you and recognize who that is. And so all my favorite singers and all my favorite guitar players, when I hear them, there's that instant recognizability. But some of that comes about from having a knack of emulating the people you grew up studying, you know. So occasionally I've given myself the luxury of if we're going to do a thematic show where we're doing Doors music or we're doing Joe Cocker's music or whatever it might be, then I'll go a little bit more down that road of emulating the people I studied a long time ago and allow myself that luxury more than I would on any given night. My vocal style is just a combination of every great singer I've ever listened to and studied, and then you try to forget about all that and just sing, and that's the most you can hope for, really. Derek and I have known each other since he was 11. We played together hundreds of times, and the rapport that we have together is borderline telepathic sometime in the way that we know each other's vocabulary so well that we're able to read each other's instincts, and it's great to have that kind of chemistry. I've had that kind of chemistry with a handful of people in my life. If you can continue to play hundreds of shows together, it just grows exponentially. So that whole band in a 14-year period just continued to keep growing like that. And I think that's the thing that we'll all miss, was the unrehearsed part of it that I'm not sure that some people realize to what extent it was unrehearsed, because it's so improvisational. When you're lucky enough to play with great musicians and to have a great chemistry, sometimes the music plays itself in a conversational way, and dare I say, better than you could rehearse it.
Got time for one more. Way in the back. Yes, sir.
You mentioned Alan Woody, the great bassist. He's actually a friend of my dad's, and I'm wondering if you can speak about the influence he had on you and what you learned from Alan Woody.
Alan Woody was my biggest comedy influence. Woody and I were a comedic duo on a daily basis, and he was one of the funniest people I've ever met, in addition to obviously being an amazing musician. He's one of the few people I've had that sort of musical chemistry with, all joking aside. And when Alan Woody passed away, oddly enough, the first two phone calls that I got were from Phil Esch and from Greg Allman, and both talking about losing a profound relationship, musically speaking, you know. And I don't know if this is accurate. Somebody told me that Alan Woody and I played over 1,200 shows together. And what that does for your chemistry is, in the case, chemistry has to start at the beginning, but if you allow it to grow, what that does for your chemistry is just unbelievable.
So, I can't let you get away and not ask about the Christmas show.
Okay.
We were talking about it before. You got to talk about this lineup you have in December. Who's playing on the show?
Christmas Jam, which is my charity show in Asheville, North Carolina, that I've been doing for 27 years. This year, the Doobie Brothers, the Tedeschi Trucks Band, Dawes, Bruce Hornsby, Blackberry Smoke, Joe Bonamassa, and Hot Tuna.
Wow.
In addition
anybody you've heard of?
So the phrase "play all night" comes to mind.
Yeah. Well, that's terrific. 27 years.
27 years
doing that,
and it's for Habitat for Humanity.
Yeah.
All the proceeds go to
Habitat. You know, we can keep chatting because this is just, you know, so great to listen to you and hear what you have to say.